Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Joel Mokyr of Northwestern University. Joel and I met at the American Economic Association's annual meetings in San Francisco in January 2009, where we talked about his new book, The Enlightened Economy, An Economic History of Britain from 1700 to 1850. I began by asking Joel what he meant by the expression, the enlightened economy.
It's an economy whose long-term history is affected by beliefs and ideology. And the specific beliefs and ideology I'm talking about, absent a better term, I do refer to as the Enlightenment. But it's not the kind of enlightenment that most people learn about in high school, which is associated with sort of civil rights, equality, tolerance, those kind of values, which, you know, are important, and I'm all for them, but that's not what is of interest to an economic historian. To an economic historian, what is interesting is whether these beliefs had any impact on real variables, productivity, growth, technological change, accumulation, things like that. And that's basically what the book is all about. What I argue, basically, is that over the 18th century, the influence of the Enlightenment movement in Britain increased gradually to the point where at some point in the second half of the 18th century, these things started to have real effects. And, you know, we call that, you know, the origins of modern economic growth during the British Industrial Revolution.
So what are these key ideas that you think are really at the heart of the takeoff of sustained economic growth from, say, 1800?
Well, the two key economic ideas that, as I sort of have recast them in modern terminology, are first what I would call, and we have been called by many historians of thought, the Baconian program, going back, of course, to Francis Bacon in the late 16th, early 17th century, who basically suggested to change the agenda of scientific research. And the idea is basically that knowledge was meant, as he phrased it in his sort of interesting English, for the relief of man's estate, which we translate as bringing about economic growth, increasing economic welfare, you know. And, you know, that takes a while. These ideas take a while to catch on, but we know essentially how that, after his death, Bacon became increasingly influential. There was this famous circle, an invisible college that was founded in London in the middle of the 17th century, resulting, of course, eventually into the establishment of the Royal Society in 1662. And the Royal Society, in its charter, basically says that that's what they're going to do. They're going to collect and develop and augment knowledge so that it could be useful in what we would call today technological change. Now, the Royal Society was always very consistent about this, so it sort of wanes and waxes about this, but other organizations are ready to take up where they leave off, and so as you go deeper into the 18th century, there's more and more of these organizations who are dedicated to this kind of research. But it's not just organizations, it's basically individuals. Scientists, mathematicians, botanists, what they call natural philosophers, all of them start to be increasingly interested in technological issues. And they do what we would call today R&D, except that this is not done by some firm. These are individuals engaging in that. But one of the things that economists never ask, or rarely ask, is what determines the agenda of scientific research. Why do scientists pick one problem and not another? And I think there's some kind of implicit assumption that they look around and see what is it that the world needs. But that's not at all obvious, okay? They could just be entirely internally driven, so essentially wondering about, you know, metaphysical, theological issues. And much scientific research, certainly before 1500, was of that nature. Or people are trying to do things like predict the future from astrology. Now, that is, in some sense, an applied thing, but not something that we would think of as particularly technological. Well, in the 17th and 18th century, an increasing number of people who do science in Britain are deeply interested in applied issue. You know, all the way from things like farming, you know, bleaching and dyeing, mining technology, geology becomes a field because people have to find where the coal is. Of course, in medicine, this is particularly striking that people get, you know, basically start investigating nature because all of a sudden they realize that if they know more, they can cure people. Well, strange as it may sound, this is actually a new notion that for generations and generations, basically there was a body of medicine brought over from much from antiquity, people like Ibn Sina, you know, the famous Muslim doctor, or Galen, Roman guy, or Razis, another an Iranian, and these people had written these massive volumes, and then basically that was their, what was to know. I mean, why do research? Well, that starts, you know, a little bit before Bacon, but particularly after that, increasing number of people start questioning and say, look, we can know more, you know. So across the board, you see scientists, mathematicians, doctors saying, hey, we can fix things. You know, we don't have to take nature as given. This is not God's will. We're going to figure out how to either cure or more likely prevent diseases. So it's not surprising that in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, you have something like smallpox, vaccination. But basically, the 18th century sees the conquest of smallpox by people who say, you know, we are going to lick this baby. We're going to destroy smallpox. By knowing more, we can do it. And it works. Now, the issues are very difficult, and some of them are way beyond them, right? So it's by no means successful across the board. But what you can think of the Baconian program in the second half of the 18th century, this massive attack of people trying to accumulate knowledge on this on the budget constraint, on the technological budget constraints of that society. Now, as you might imagine, they're successful in some areas, and in some areas the resistance is very, very tough. So, for instance, in agriculture, there is very little progress because people actually don't understand why some land is more fertile, some land is less fertile, why some fertilizer works, why some fertilizer doesn't work, because they don't understand basic biochemistry of the soil, they don't understand essential entomology, you know, bacteriology, things that cause plant diseases. So they know extremely little. So it's all very, very empirical. And you get guys like Arthur Young and William Marshall running around the country taking copious notes, thinking that the more they know, the better they can make agriculture. But in fact, they don't. It's really not until the late 19th century when this is cracked. The same is true with these exceptions I mentioned for medicine. But where it works is in textiles, in metals, in engineering, in a control of heat and energy. In lots of these areas, people make fantastic progress because they really do research. So that's half the story. Now, the second half of the Enlightenment story is much more institutional and political. And again, to sort of use somewhat anachronistic terminology of our own time, what I see is the great rebellion against rent-seeking. That is to say, until about 1700 or 1750, European societies are absolutely permeated by rent-seeking. You have all kind of exclusionary arrangements, beginning with tariffs and import restrictions, all the way to guilds and occupational limits that essentially restrict what people can do so that others who already are doing it will be reaping rents. Okay? You have all kind of limitations on mobility of goods, capital and labor, not only between countries, but also within countries. England is the only country, one of the few countries in Europe, that doesn't have internal tariffs. France has internal tariffs. Germany, of course, not a country. So there's internal tariffs everywhere, same as in Italy. And so what grows over the 18th century is a conviction that economic activity is not a zero-sum game. That if I trade with you and I am better off, that doesn't mean you're worse off. This is one of the foundational assumptions of economics. But in fact, to people who are not economists, it is not obvious. We are sort of genetically programmed to think in terms of zero-sum games because our genes were formed in these small tribal groups in which if my group had more, then it usually came at the expense of this other group because, you know, I shot their mammoth or whatever. Of course, in the 18th century, an increasing number of people take exception to this very mercantilist notion that if trade occurs, one gained and the other lost. And of course, in the end, this all came to a sort of a crashing crescendo in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. But as Schumpeter said, you know, when the Wealth of Nations published in 1776, there is very little in it that's new. This stuff had been around for 75 years, and I can give you ad nauseum all the people who were, you know, the French physiocrats, you know, Quesnay, Montesquieu in a somewhat different way, but also in Britain, guys like Josiah Tucker and even David Hume, you know, this is the idea that trade is somehow good and redistribution is bad, ripened, I think, in the 18th century. And that is a critical part of the Enlightenment because it implies a whole range of institutional reforms that make the economy work better. And that in some sense prevent what could have happened, which is you could I can imagine a society which has become much more technologically creative because of the Baconian program, but that rent seekers would have siphoned off the profits of the entrepreneurs who are making the money, either by higher taxes or by some other mechanism. I mean, this is conceivable, and there's lots of times when this actually happens. Well, it doesn't happen in Britain. I think in fact, if there's anything, is that people get increasingly averse to monopolies. So whatever monopoly power remains in the East India Company, for instance, is gotten rid of in the 1780s, and there's a few reforms after that, then they demonopolize banking. Of course, the Bank of England, which is the only monopoly that remains, becomes an arm of the state. So that's okay, but there are no private monopolies. And in Britain, you have complete freedom of mobility. Capital can move from area to area. So these things are all introduced one after the other. And one of the striking things is, for instance, is how weak the resistance against new technology turns out to be. So there's always vested interests of incumbents, right? So if you have been making, you know, combing wool, to pick a famous example, for generations a certain way, and somebody invents a wool combing machine that makes all of your jobs redundant, you're not going to like that. Okay, you're going to go to Parliament, you're going to file a petition, and you're going to ask for them to prohibit it, citing in some sense national interest, you know, the well-being of the community, or, you know, finding some excuse. And what is amazing about Industrial Revolution in Britain is that these things never work. That when there is an uprising of people in rebelling against machines, for instance, during the Luddite riots, the government doesn't think for a minute. They send over the troops. Part of it is, of course, that they realize that technological change is good. But I think it's deeper than that. I think they understand that there are people in society who benefit from certain kinds of monopolistic power, and they're well determined to get rid of it. As a result, by 1830 or 1840, I would say, I'd be very hard-pressed to think of any examples in Britain where rent-seeking is still actually going on. There's a famous story about this, which may be apocryphal, about the Duke of Wellington when he becomes Prime Minister. And he writes this letter and he said, I thought I would have a lot of patronage to give away. And there isn't any patronage left because they basically, you know, the reforms in British government, and particularly I think there's two or three waves of them. One of them is sort of during the Burke-Pitt reforms in the 1780s. And then after 1815, there's a growing critique by the radicals against some of the practices that were established during the Napoleonic Wars. And they get rid of all of this stuff. And the British government is actually contracting. And, of course, there's a major, if very slow, move towards free trade. Now, it's not linear. It's not a smooth path up. The Corn Laws of 1815 clearly are a big step backward. So this battle is not won in one day. But when you get to the middle of the 19th century, okay, the Corn Laws are gone. You know, whatever's left of the guilds are gone. Any kind of restrictions, navigation acts that were passed under Cromwell, for Christ's sake, in 1849 finally they're thrown out. The Bubble Act, another big act of rent-seeking, gone. All of the limitations on banking essentially eliminated with the Banking Act of 1844. And so this is an economy that is, I don't want to call it the laissez-faire economy, because that really never existed. But they're getting damn close. And they're getting close because I think the Enlightenment program, okay, which then sort of morphs into what we would call today classical liberal political economy, basically sort of takes the stand that rent-seeking is bad and we should get rid of it as soon as we can. And as a result, the role of government in Britain is obviously redefined and, I think, to some extent contracts. But what it also means is that a lot of public goods that the government usually supplies have to be provided privately. Okay, so this is a society in which the government provides no education, no health care, very little police protection, no prosecution. I mean, the government does, in fact, well, they have a navy, and then there's justices of peace that sort of arbitrate local disputes, usually unpaid, usually amateurs. So these people aren't even paid. They're sort of supported by government, but they're not actually paid until the 19th century. So this is a government that does about as little as they can possibly do. But the net result is, of course, there's almost no rent-seeking. All the arguments have been made by Will Beaumont and, you know, Vishnu Schleifer about why rent-seeking is bad hold in reverse for Enlightenment Britain. You know, there is no rent-seeking. So if you wanted to make money, and you wanted to have a career, Well, how many options were there outside of not going into business? Well, in Prussia you could become a general, and in lots of places you could still become some kind of, you know, lobbyist or whatever. But in Britain, really, if you wanted to pull yourself up, okay, you went into business, and it became quite respectable. Of course, the sons and grandsons of industrialists sat in Parliament, became Prime Minister. All of that was happening. But it is largely because rent-seeking, essentially, the phenomenon disappears. Now, it's to come back. Rent-seeking is, you know, it's like this nasty virus. Okay, it always flares up again when you think you've gotten rid of it. But there is, I think, a window, but somewhere between 1760, I'd say, and 1880, maybe, in which there's very little of it in Britain. And I think that really makes a very big difference. Not in that it generates technological change as such, but because it sort of stops dead the various forces that could have prevented it from happening and which do stand in the way elsewhere. So in those two dimensions, I think this is really an enlightened economy. It's maybe not surprising that it becomes the leader of Europe. But it's also not surprising that leadership isn't going to last, because the rest of the Europe, or at least Western Europe, is now they're wising up. And they see how good the Enlightenment had been for the British economy. And so when the French Revolution breaks out in 1789, essentially what the French do is first they overhaul their own system, not quite along the British lines, but not they look at Britain as an example, as, of course, does everybody else. And then once, you know, they have well-established this in France, they export it to any country they can get their hands on. So when the dust settles in Europe in 1815, you know, some of those Enlightenment values somewhat ironically have been carried on the bayonets of Napoleon's soldiers. And actually there's a paper by Darren Acemoglu, and that makes the very point, that they show that wherever the French occupied regions in continental Europe, by the late 19th century, these areas were more industrialized, more developed than others. And I don't find that surprising, because what these French soldiers were doing is they were carrying with them institutional reforms, eventually inspired by Enlightenment ideas of freedom, of occupation, of lack of monopolies, things like that. And I think this is the long overlooked secret of European economic development. The economists may not be happy to hear this, because we are, in some sense, historical materialists. We like to think that ideology and beliefs and religion and so on are all endogenous to economic factors. And I'm arguing, if anything, the reverse. I'm arguing that ideology, religion, and beliefs, you know, have a dynamic all of their own. Of course, not completely uninfluenced by economic environment, but not necessarily fully determined by it either. Because what is happening in this game of the Enlightenment is people persuade each other. Okay? We are actually communicating. We are talking about cultural change that is the result of particular individuals being very, very influential. And these things happen in human history, whether we like them or not. I mean, Karl Marx was one such individual. So was Muhammad. And so was Jesus. I mean, there are a few individuals who actually change people's minds, even if the economic circumstances weren't quite appropriate. And nobody can tell me that the economic circumstances in Russia in 1917 were, you know, were screaming for a proletarian revolution, because there is no proletarian. So that, but these guys, like, you know, Lenin, pulled it off. I think in what you see, there's no single individual in 18th century Britain that plays the role of a Muhammad or a Luther or somebody like that. But there is a small group of highly influential thinkers, of which Adam Smith is the best known, but clearly there's a large number of people behind him. And even though these people disagree on lots of things, okay, they agree on, I would say, three fundamental points. A, that economic progress is possible and desirable. Two, writing down an agenda of how to bring it about. And three, writing down specific policy measures of how to carry out this program.
What does your thesis, your story of the enlightened economy have to say to modern concerns about growth and development?
I'm, of course, a great believer in Enlightenment values. And I am struck by the fact that many of the countries that have failed to undergo modern economic development are countries in which the Enlightenment has been clearly been rejected, whereas in other countries where it has penetrated, if not taken over the place, we see, if with sort of long lags, economic development taking off. So the two classic examples would be, in a very different context, would be China and India. So India, of course, could never quite protect itself against Enlightenment values, because the British were force feeding them to them, and even so the British left in 1948, but they left them with the world's largest democracy. Well, nobody's going to convince me that if Britain had never occupied India, that India would have turned sort of democratic on its own volition. This was a leftover of the Raj, and I don't think the Indians would be, I think the Indians would be the first to admit that. Now, it is also true, of course, that it took them another 50 years until they were able to get around the issue that rent-seeking was really bad, and they haven't quite gotten around that yet. But there are signs that it is now slowly fading, and the Indian economy is growing accordingly. China is a very different story. China, in some sense, never really adopted the institutional values of the Enlightenment. But what they did, I think, learn from the West, as Japan did a century earlier, is that knowledge is economic progress. And so then that without modern technology, you're not going to go anywhere. So in that sense, they have adopted portions of the Western Enlightenment, but not the whole thing. But the main conclusion I draw from this is that if you are going to hope for economic development, what you really do need is to find ways to change the deeply held cultural beliefs of large chunks of the population, or at least those chunks of the population that do matter. And that turns out to be an incredibly hard problem. We're not doing terribly well at that, even in Europe, because if you look at Balkan countries, Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia, for instance, Moldavia, these countries are deeply corrupt. And that I think a notion that corruption is somehow insufferable and intolerable, that is a deeply held Enlightenment value. The Enlightenment didn't invent it, okay, the Romans had that too. But I think the notion that this is not only morally wrong, but also economically inefficient, that's an 18th century view. I think the Romanians haven't figured it out yet, because the country is deeply corrupt. Same is true about half the other countries in Eastern Europe. And I think as long as that doesn't happen, they will have a very hard time actually taking their position within communities of more enlightened countries. And the EU is going to have to face that problem, because they are now putting together countries like Denmark and Netherlands in the same boat as Greece and Bulgaria. And that is going to be, I think, a major problem. I think the same is true certainly for Turkey. But if you look at countries that have deliberately rejected enlightenment value, like Islamic theocracies such as Iran or, to a lesser extent, Pakistan, I would be very pessimistic about their development views, because I think what you need to have, it's not religion itself that's bad. Britain, 18th century Enlightenment Britain, is a deeply religious society. Don't ever let anybody tell you that they were all becoming a bunch of crazy atheists. That's not true. I mean, they were very deeply religious, okay? But for them, God was an enlightened creature that wanted them to make money and exploit the world and sort of behave decently toward other people and not have monopolies and not be corrupt. Now, I think if people adopt that kind of religion, that's fine with me. But that's not the way I read how the theocracy works in either Pakistan or Iran or another Islamic country, nor for that matter in Eastern Europe or in much of Africa. And that is something that I would say has a pessimistic implication, because culture changes very slowly.
John McKay, thank you very much.